and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud puts us on an airplane and flies us halfway around the world this week as we begin our journey to Australia here on the Studcast. And without any further ado, the man of the hour, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. And Ron, you've been waiting for this for a while, because I know, beyond even just the wrestling, you loved Australia.
Oh, yes. I mean, this is just a pleasure for me. I like to have started. I wish I could have started with this at the very first Studcast. It's just a remarkable place, a beautiful place, and a culture that's different than ours in this country. It's just a fantastic place, and I've been really looking forward to getting to this time frame, and we may be here for a few programs because I think fans are going to really enjoy this. And before we go any further, Brian, I just want to thank the fans for the tremendous response in the Atlanta Wrestling War, the trilogy, the three programs, and just fantastic numbers. A lot of people obviously really enjoyed that. Comments have just been amazing and through the roof. Can't answer all of them. It's just been really a good thing for us to do. Obviously, it's in that time frame of late 72, the beginning of it, and it's just worked out really great. And I just want to thank all those thousands and thousands of fans out there that have sent comments and seem to really enjoy the history of the Atlanta Wrestling War.
As you told the story, of course, at the beginning of December 1972, you touched down in Atlanta, you worked a television taping, you met with Aunt Gunkle. Less than a month later, you were going to a whole nother world. I shouldn't say another world. You were going to a whole nother continent, and that was Australia.
Yes, I'm boarding the plane, and let's just start right there. My family and I, my wife, I've got two sons at this point. We board the first plane, because we're going to take several planes in order to get to Australia. And we board the first plane in West Palm Beach, Florida, on January 2nd, 1973, a couple days after New Year. And we're headed out for Sydney. I got two sons. One of them is 20 months old, and the other one is 2 months old.
Long a flight, that must be awful.
Oh, Kent. Well, we're going to get into it here. I mean, it is. It is truly awful. So we're getting on a plane. We're flying from West Palm Beach, Florida, to Sydney, Australia. It's 9,364 miles as the crow flies. But we're going to add another 1,000 miles to that 9,300. It's going to be over 10,000 miles because we're not going to fly like the crow. We're going to have to go to Atlanta. We're going to have to go to L.A. We're going to have to go to Honolulu. And then we're going to have to go to Sydney. So it's going to be a long, long trip. We're going to change planes at Atlanta. We'll change planes in Los Angeles. We'll change planes in Honolulu. And we're going to have to stop and refuel halfway between Honolulu and Sydney in a little island in the Pacific called New Caledonia. So we're going to be really, we're going to cross the equator. We're going to cross the international date line. We're going to add a day when we cross the date line. We're going to be in the air for 22 hours. We're going to be on planes for 22 and a half hours of the whole 32 hours that it's going to take us to get there, including we're going to have to change planes. We're going to have to refuel. So it is the longest day of my life. I'll never forget that trip. And you've got two babies and you're traveling halfway around the world. It was really, really a monster event so far as being able to handle all of this travel and all of the things that goes on in the plane. Now, you got to add to that fact, I'm 6'9 and weigh about 270 pounds at this time.
Yeah.
And I've got no leg room most of the time. I'm fighting to get on bulkhead. Thank God I got two little babies, or I probably wouldn't have got the bulkhead. But because those babies were so small, they had to sleep in little cribs. And most of those planes had a way that you could, there was a bed that you stuck into the wall. It actually just went into the bulkhead and that held the babies there. So it was like, wow, it was a monster of a trip. When you go that far and, you spend that time in those airports waiting on plane changes, and it's just a real struggle.
Anyone who's flown internationally, I'm sure, is aware that if you go to an airport that is somewhat small, maybe you can get in and out pretty quickly. If you go to Heathrow, if you go to a bigger airport, you're going to get off that plane, that long flight, let alone 22 hours on the flight, and stand in line to deal with customs. So what was that like?
Oh, well, you know, you don't have to deal with customs until you get to Sydney. And luckily that was a piece of cake, because Jim Barnett is so well known over there. He has a tremendous relationship with the Australian Prime Minister. And I went through customs. They actually pulled me and my wife and my two babies out of the line with everybody else, took us through a side door, never even checked our bags. We cleared customs in less than 5 minutes in Sydney. I was expecting to spend an hour and a half in customs. We were pulled out of line, and just because they recognized us, Jim had already sent the message, Ron Fuller, he's tall, he's coming in on such and such flight. And they just came to us, a couple of agents, and just said, come on, follow us. And we went through a side door and right into a limousine and headed downtown Sydney. So that part of it was really, really simple. But the trip itself was a monster and very, very difficult, obviously. So we finally landed in Sydney. Like I said, we cleared customs. That's no problem. I was expecting it to be a big problem. When they pulled us out and I got to asking, I said, you know, what's the deal here? Why is it that we're being treated like royalty? And they said, Mr. Barnett, they call him Mr. Barnett, the two agents. So Mr. Barnett informed us you were coming in, and we've got a special relationship with Mr. Barnett. And we just bring wrestlers. When wrestlers come in, we just whisk them right out of there. So it was my first example of the power and the influence of Jim Barnett was right there at the airport, and the way I was whisked right through that customs operation. So they take us downtown, this nice limo. We go across the big bridge that is right beside the big opera house. I mean, it's the most recognizable probably structure in all of Australia. Beautiful, beautiful thing. The bridge itself is pretty spectacular. And into downtown Sydney. Now, we're in 1973. Just to give people an idea, in 1973, there were 13 million people in Australia. That was the population of the entire country. Today, it's 24 million. They've almost doubled in size. In that time frame, been a long time. We're talking 1973, 45 years ago. So, you know, they're still not a monster country, but it's just a beautiful, beautiful place. We go to downtown, a section called King's Cross. This is back during the time of Vietnam. And there was a lot of soldiers in that King's Cross area because they had in those times they would give those soldiers they had a name. I can't think of the term for it, but they would give them leave basically for 2 weeks or 3 weeks at a time. And they could go where they wanted to. And most soldiers picked to go to Sydney. They wanted to go to Australia. So that was a whole lot of American soldiers down there in that time frame. We go into we check into a hotel in Sydney there down in King's Cross. And it's very close to where Jim resides. And Jim resides in the penthouse of the Chevron Hilton Hotel, which is just down the street, big monster hotel. And not only does he have the penthouse, but he has the whole top floor of the Chevron Hilton. And now Jim Barnett is a phenomenal character when it comes to wrestling. There is probably no figure that has the everybody talks about him and everybody, they feel differently about him. But he lives the high life. I mean, he lives in the very finest places. I can't imagine what it cost you to live in the penthouse of a Hilton hotel. It's got to be pretty expensive. And the rest of the top floor was his offices for his wrestling company. So then, you know, I don't know how you can have a more expensive office than a top floor of a Hilton hotel. Don't even have any idea what that costs. Jim Barnett is gay, and he's not a closet person. He's out. And I mean, this is back in 1973. He never hides that fact in his entire life, I don't believe. He's a very, very smart guy, well-educated. And since we're on the subject of Jim Barnett, let's just talk about a little bit of Jim Barnett's history and what he did in wrestling in his earlier years, how he gets to Australia, and a little bit of what happens to him afterward. He starts his wrestling journey as a bookkeeper for Fred Kohler in 1949. Fred Kohler is the promoter in Chicago. Kohler's promoting Chicago, and Jim Barnett has just finished college. He's well educated, he's ambitious, and he has a mind for making money. And I mean, he has a mind for making money in the wrestling business. He has one of those Midas touches. He recognizes talent. He really perceives the importance of television and what it's going to do for wrestling. So even in 1949, he's beginning to see that television is just coming available to people. And so he takes this opportunity and he runs with it. He talks Kohler into getting with the Dumont Network. Television back in those days, it was so in its infancy that there really weren't even three networks. The networks were just beginning to put themselves together. So in different regions of the country had their own little networks. And Dumont was a network. It was basically up there in the Chicago area. And so they get their wrestling show on the Dumont Network, and they start running in Chicago and Detroit and Indianapolis, Louisville, Kentucky, Lexington, Kentucky, and they start doing big business. Right away, television, you know, my granddad always told me, and my dad always said that, the same thing. They said that wrestling made television, and television made wrestling. And that's exactly what happened, because before television, you didn't have a way to get your stars over. You didn't have the ability to have people being able to see. If they didn't buy a ticket, they didn't know who the hell anybody was, and they didn't care, and they weren't going to become steady customers. But once they got that television and they could see those guys' faces and they could see the sport, it just was a perfect combination for TV. They were doing these studio programs, which meant didn't have to have a big setup. You didn't have to have a bunch of cameras. It was easy to televise. It was exciting for the people. And I remember my dad telling me that in the late 40s, early 50s, that
people would stop on the street. Televisions were expensive, and they would put them in the showroom windows of the big department stores, and people would stand on the street. He said that sometimes they would block traffic because wrestling was on. They would stop and watch the wrestling, and the crowd would grow and grow and grow. And so Jim Barnett perceives this. He sees this way, way back, long before other promoters see it. And so he gets the Dumont Network all set up, and then he goes after the Marigold Syndication as a syndicator that wanted to have programming. So he gets with the Marigold Syndication, and that puts him into Denver. It puts him into L.A., and it puts him into other major cities across the country. And he basically then has the first national television show in America, basically, where he's practically being seen in a huge part of America. This, I believe, is prior to even the networks having the capability to do that. So he's a sharp son of a gun. He's figured out a way not only to get on these different stations in different big cities, but he's about to figure out how to get his national program set up long before anybody ever dreamed of being able to do it. The National Wrestling Alliance formed in 1948. He gets involved in 1949. There's no real power within the National Wrestling Alliance at that point. A few promoters here and there, they're adding promoters from around the country and from around other parts of the world. But that's a slow process. It takes a lot of years for the National Wrestling Alliance to become the hoss that they do become. So once he gets, because of his perception of the TV, and it serves him well for the future, because he's going to end up in Atlanta with Ted Turner's TBS. I mean, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons he comes to America. That's one of the reasons he wants that. He wants that opportunity to hook up with the big guy that's got a means of being able not just to cover the country, but to cover the world with his satellite. So in 1964, he's had great years. There's a story I always loved about Barnett, and he would always drive in a limo. He never owned a car or drove a car. He had a limo and a driver, and it would take him everywhere. And he would go into Chicago and the big old amphitheater way, way back. And they had a big curtain, big stage like a lot of buildings had. And he would go to the curtain. They would drive him up to the back of the building. He would go in the back door. He would go to the curtain. He would pull the curtain back to see the crowd. And then he would say, somebody told me that they were standing by him, and they heard that he said he would look at the crowd, and he would go, "Oh, God," he goes, "it's another sellout. Might as well go home." And he would turn around and go back and get in the limo and go home. He wouldn't even talk to any of the wrestlers. He wouldn't go back to the dressing room. He just wanted to see those sellouts. So he's just a tremendous character in wrestling. In all of professional wrestling, he's maybe the biggest character of all time. So by 1964, he's ready to move out of these areas. He sells Detroit to Farhat, Eddie Farhat, the Sheik. And he Indianapolis, he sells to a Bruiser. He divides his business up, and he dispenses with everything, and he goes to Australia because he wants not just a territory, he wants a country, he wants a continent, and there's nobody there. So he goes there, he takes with him Johnny Doyle. Johnny Doyle is one of his partners in Indianapolis, and he has great faith in Johnny Doyle. And he takes Johnny Doyle with him. They've been together since 1958. They run their first show in Sydney on October 23rd, 1964. They stay there for 10 years. And after 10 years' time there, he's going to sell out. He sells out to a gentleman named Tony Kalani. And then he comes to Atlanta because My dad is involved with him, and Eddie, I believe, is involved with. There's a great relationship building between my father and Jim Barnett, and Eddie and Jim Barnett. And those three guys are going to pretty much control the South, and eventually they're going to just about control the National Wrestling Alliance. So the dad goes over there. That's why we're going in 73, is because dad is bought in with Barnett. And I'm not so sure that Eddie Graham is not part of that as well. But it's not common knowledge. I never asked my dad about personal things like that, about that type of stuff. So he would have been glad to tell me. But anyway,
let me ask you, though, if I may, Ron.
Yeah.
You said your father bought in. You didn't say he bought out Jim Barnett. A lot of people think that your father, and sometimes people say Eddie, sometimes people say your grandfather, Roy, with your father, bought out Jim Barnett before the sale to Tony Colone. Did he buy in or did he buy him out?
No, he bought in.
Okay.
He had a piece of it. And I don't know what percentage he had, but I know he had a piece of it because when we went there in 1973, he told me, he said, I own part of it. I want you to go. I want you to see what's happening there. You may be do something there, you know. My dad was a pretty crazy guy. I mean, he wanted to see the world, and he had these huge ideas and thought processes. And he saw a lot of potential in Australia, obviously, because you're not going to have competition. And all the TVs are tied up. Jim Barnett's already done that and tied up all the televisions and everything. So it seems like a great business opportunity, and it was a great business opportunity. Once I get there, I see it. I see the fans. They are the most, they're the most similar to American wrestling fans of any place I've ever wrestled on earth. They like the same things that American wrestling fans like. They're not like the Japanese who sit there on their hands and they don't get into the matches. They're just like the American fans. They're going to scream and they're going to holler. They're going to do everything like you were wrestling in America. And that's always makes you feel comfortable in the ring. When you're out there, you want that crowd reaction. It makes everything easier and it makes everything better. So we're there in 73, and I think at this point probably there's discussion going on. The war is going on in Atlanta at this point. And I'm pretty sure that there's a lot of discussion between Dad and Barnett and maybe Eddie Graham. He's not there. He doesn't come to Australia then, but he's going to come to Australia 6 months later. So that's what I think makes Eddie have part of this as well. But they are talking about Atlanta. I'm sure they're saying, look, this war is going to be over someday. And Turner's not developed TBS to the point it's going to be. And they start talking about the potential of Atlanta and that television station with Ted Turner. And that's where I think he leaves in 74. Barnett sells out. Dad sells out. They all leave, and they all focus on Atlanta. Barnett's the one guy in all of wrestling that's got the money to be able to buy out both of the two warring companies that are there, Lester and Ann. They're both tired of the war. It's took a lot out of them. And he goes in and just buys out both parties so that there's no question about it. The war's over. He is the man in Atlanta. And it's pretty much history from there, what happens in Atlanta. It just thrives. It just does tremendous from there on. Later on, I'm just going to go past the Atlanta War in 74. I'm going to go to what happens to him as time goes on here. Jim controls wrestling there in the Atlanta area. He's going to sell it to Vince. Starting in 1980s, he's going to have key roles. He's going to play key roles in the WWE, the WCW, and Jim Crockett's company. He's going to either be a senior advisor or a consultant, or one time he was vice president of Titan Sports, which is WWE. He is going to be highly involved in wrestling until his death in September of 2004. And if you look at his history and what he did in his time frame between the late 40s and up into the 2000s, 60 years. He's got six decades of history in the sport. I don't know that there's a bigger figure in all of wrestling than Jim Barnett.
And he had a front row seat to wrestling on the Dumont Network, becoming a national sensation. He had a front row seat to the national expansion of Vince McMahon. He had a front row seat to cable television and wrestling and that relationship. He was there from the very beginning, and if you look at all the moves with television, he had a lot to do with some of the biggest things that happened to wrestling.
I hear that the first three big shows that Vince did, WrestleManias, were Barnett. Barnett pieced all that together for him, helped him put all that together. So, he's a critical figure in professional wrestling. And I really love talking about Jim because I become very good friends with Jim. He buys me out in Knoxville when I have a problem. So, you know, Jim and I start a relationship in the early 70s, and we go on into to darn near 2000. And I spend a lot of time with Jim. He comes to my second wedding, and I mean, he's just a tremendous friend and, just a fabulous character in all of wrestling.
Hey, Ron, one more question before we move on, because I did mention it. Some people think that your grandfather was involved in this as well. I know some people have put that story out there. To the best of your knowledge, did your grandfather have anything to do with this deal that your father was putting together with Jim Barnett, with Eddie Graham involved?
No. Roy definitely did not. Now, Roy, at this time, Roy started wrestling in 1924. He was born in 1902. When you're talking about 1972, just in the Atlanta War time frame, that's 70 years old. At 70 years old, he's not interested in Australia. He's basically pretty much retired, and he doesn't do much with wrestling at all at that point. In fact, he has one of the biggest dairies in the South that he's also running, that he built during the time he was running his wrestling companies. So he's not involved in any of this, and his relationship with my father was always an antagonistic relationship. They was never close, and he never really wanted my dad to be a wrestler. He actually probably stole Memphis from him in 1960 after Dad went in and just exploded business in Memphis and set up the TV that they kept for so many years, made it the big monster city that it became. I think Roy was pretty much responsible for having him get kicked out of Memphis. So, you know, there's not a great relationship between those two, and there was no way that Roy would have been involved in Australia at all.
So there's no way your father would say, hey, I want to buy into Australia. Dad, come on, buy in with me. That would never happen.
Oh, no, no. I mean, they could hardly sit down at the table for 15 minutes and talk civilly to each other. I mean, it just they didn't have a very good relationship. And there's no way that could have happened. That's a general idea of that's a quick picture of Jim Barnett. So, but let's go back now to January 6th, 1973. Jim Barnett's very much still alive, okay? And we've just gotten in there. We've been a couple of days in a hotel, and he has all of his wrestlers come in there on January 6th of 73 at the Chevron Hilton Hotel for a meeting. He brings his crew, his new crew. Now, he's basically changing out his crews about once every 3 months. So this is a new crew. But some of the people were in the tour before. They come back again because they've gotten over. And he's a smart guy. He knows who's over and who's not. He's bringing some of them back again. So they escort us. I go in, and I'm escorted to the top to the top floor and into a big conference room, and there's a bunch of wrestlers in the conference room already. And it is customary when you go into a dressing room you've never been, you go around and introduce yourself to those that you don't know, shake hands, you start making building relationships. You try to build relationships with wrestlers, with your talent. At this point, I'm not a promoter yet, but that's kind of how you get your foot in the door with guys, and you make an impression on them that being a nice guy or whatever. So everybody's sitting around in the conference room, and they're talking to each other. And my dad's there. He's involved in the company. He's in the conference room. The only person not in the conference room is Jim. And so we sit there talking to each other, and all of a sudden, you know, in walks, and I had not had at this point in 70 and 73 a lot of interaction with Jim. I had seen Jim on a couple of occasions, but I wasn't real, I didn't know him very well. And so here he comes in, and Jim is now, he's not a big guy. He's probably 5'7". He's got a little pot belly. He's got a little fat there on the front of his body, and he has a habit of folding his arms and kind of laying them on top of his little pot belly. He has the wire rim glasses, the black wire rim glasses that he always wore, and he comes into the room, and he struts across in front of everybody, and he comes up to a podium that's at the front of the room. And as soon as he walks in, everybody's talking, it just becomes immediately silent. It's like he made his entrance. I mean, and Jim liked to do this. He really enjoyed that spotlight, and he liked to make that big entrance. And yeah, I see a lot of it as time goes by when I'm wrestling for him in Atlanta and the Omni shows and a lot of different times like that. He wants to come in and make his grand entrance. So he makes his grand entrance, and he comes to the podium, and he hesitates, and he looks over all the crew. Now everybody is silent, and he takes at least a minute before he says anything. And his eyes go back from one side of the room to the next, front row, back row, and then he goes, "I'll buy." He goes, "I see nothing here but money, money, money." So I was like, and he didn't say much beyond that. He made a couple of more comments about, "I think we're going to do very well." And he just kind of set the stage. And then he walked back out just like he came in. And some people, you know, a lot of guys went to Australia not realizing who Jim Barnett was and not knowing his lifestyle. And they were freaked. There were guys that you know, went, "Wow, geez, is that Barnett?" You know, "Yeah, that's Barnett." And they go, "Oh, my gosh." You know, So, you know, he makes his little presence known. So since we're here and we're talking about the talent here, we're in this conference room. Jim comes in. He makes his little pitch, very short. He slides out of the room. And so I'm going to go through who was there, who was in this crew in 1973. It's the first crew of 1973. They're going to be there from January through the end of March. And so you've got from the USA, you've got Dick Dunn and Don Carson, two great, great workers and worked as tag teams. My very first wrestling match in my life was against Dick Dunn and Don Carson. And my grandmother and my great grandmother got arrested and taken out because they had so much heat with a green guy that had never had a match before. Great talents. They had Dale Lewis and Bob Griffin. These guys are going to be mass wrestlers. They're going to be called the Mass Medics. Two super workers. Danny Little Bear. great Indian type wrestler, had the Indian headgear, is an Indian. I mean, he's and a darn good worker too. Bob Roop is in this crew. Scott Casey is in this crew. Paul DeMarco is in the crew. Dennis McCourt, who is going to become, within the next year or so, Austin Idol. But his name, his real name is Dennis McCourt, and he's still wrestling as Dennis McCourt at that time frame. Greg Peterson. There's a midget in the crew named Bobo Johnson. And a referee from Georgia named Doug Smith, who is a personal friend of mine and my brother's. And we knew him when my brother was played ball with him in high school. And he becomes a referee. Jim takes a liking to him and demands that he come to Australia. And Doug Smith is going to work for Jim Barnett for the next 10 years. And he's a great referee and a great guy. From Greece. Now, this is where Barnett separates himself from a lot of other promoters. He likes to have a world-class territory. He wants to have talent from other countries. So he has from Greece a guy named Spiros Arion, who is just fantastic. I really, really loved to watch this guy in the ring. He was really, really good. From Italy, Mario Milano. Milano's, and both these guys not only speak English, but they speak their native language. And Jim's going to benefit from that because he's going to have, there's a big population in Australia of Greeks and Italians. And a lot of them live in the certain little parts of the towns together, and they don't speak English. So on television, he has Spiros and he has Mario do an interview in English and finish in Greek or in Italian, which I thought was wonderful. I mean, I was very impressed by that. They would do that interview and then they would do it again in their own language. And that was helping them to draw a lot more fans than they would have normally got had they not spoken in that native tongue. From New Zealand, John Da Silva, great guy, pretty decent shooter, too. From Japan, there was another midget named Little Tokyo. And then, obviously, there's a large contingent of Australian wrestlers, but we're going to talk about them later. There are some guys in this crew in 1973, Aussie guys, guys that are doing jobs, the guys that aren't working on top, but that are going to become stars in America. And they do that, some of them, because of Dad. Dad really gets into these guys. He starts giving them special training. And toward the end of this tour, he does an angle with them that's just phenomenal with a guy named George Barnes. And we'll get to that later on.
We will return to Australia in just a moment. But first, a word about the next Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 10.
Thanks to all of our loyal listeners and patrons, the last three Atlanta Wrestling War Studcasts have all been record breakers. Now, the stud sets his sights on another Super Studcast record breaker. And to get it done, he brings in one of the biggest guns in all of podcasting history. This guest is controversial, intellectual, successful, and hysterical in more ways than one. He is internationally recognized as one of the best managers of all time. It's not unusual for wrestlers to bring a particular item to the ring, like Ron Wright's chisel, the Honky Tonk Man and his famous guitar, Jake the Snake Roberts and a snake, or even Stone Cold Steve Austin with a can of beer. But why would you bring a tennis racket? We could only be talking about the Louisville Lip, the despised playboy, the tennis racket-toting, loudmouth racket-making Jim Cornette. On Tuesday, October 9th, we're going to open the cage for a Super Studcast number 10 and let the wild man out for a super good time with one of the stud's best friends. Find it at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99. You better cinch that saddle up tight and hold that saddle horn until your knuckles turn white, because there's no telling where this three-hour ride is going to take us. This face-to-face encounter between two great icons of the sport is what Super Studcast are all about, and it's available now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast.
There you hear it. Explosive news here on the Studcast. Super Studcast number 10 will be coming at you on Tuesday, October 9th with none other than Jim Cornette. TNstud.com or Patreon.com/Studcast, only $2.99. Ron Fuller and Jim Cornette for 2 hours. This has to be something to be heard. I assume we haven't recorded it yet. But I would encourage you to check it out. Once again, TNstud.com or Patreon.com/Studcast. We will have more information later in the program. But Ron, let's return to Australia now. You were in this meeting. You mentioned all of the other wrestlers that were there. Obviously, Mario Milano and Spiros Arion are two of the three biggest stars Jim Barnett ever had in Australia, Dominic DiNucci being the other one. But do you talk to Barnett at all, one-on-one?
Well, after the meeting, Jim looks me up, and he takes me off into a room that has, it's an office, part of the office, and there's an Aussie there that runs, and he says, Ron, would you mind staying with this? He's going to ask you a few questions, and so he disappears again, and I sit down there, and Aussie says to me, he goes, hey, mate, he goes, how often do you want to work while you're here in Australia? And I said, you know, wow, I hadn't even thought about it, you know. And so I said, you know, I'm a third generation wrestler. I said, I'm here to wrestle. I'm not just here to wrestle. I've been only wrestling for less than 3 years. I'm here to learn. And I want to wrestle every time I can wrestle. And he goes, oh, mate, he goes, you're talking that we do a lot of it here. We got the TVs and we've got our shows 7 nights a week. And he goes, you could wrestle if you worked all the televisions and you worked every town, you could do, you could wrestle 10 times a week. And I said, book me 10 times a week. And he went, he dropped his head. It's like, he dropped his head. He's like, and he looks at me like, well, and he goes, mate, he goes, no one's ever wanted to work every show and every TV. I said, I want to work them all. I'm here to learn, man. I want to leave here a much better wrestler than I am right now. And so that's that. And they took me at my word, and they not only booked me every night, but they booked me to shoot with a lot of guys, Australian guys, and on televisions, I would do these exhibits of wrestling holds and shooting holds and things like that. They worked me to death. I would go out and shoot sometimes with two guys and then go back and work later in the night with a regular opponent. So
Hold on. When you say shoot, what exactly do you mean?
I mean, they would get on the microphone and they would go, if you would like to wrestle, anybody here think that they would like to be a wrestler, we have a wrestler here tonight that will get in the ring with you. And anybody, whatever you do, we don't care. He'll guarantee to beat you in less than 5 minutes. That was my deal. They said, well, how are you going to do this? I said, well, you know, let's say if I don't beat him in 5 minutes, you know, that you didn't declare him a winner. So, you know, so they would line up. You know, I mean, you know, we did this. I've done the same thing. I did it with Dale Lewis later on, who's in this crew in Knoxville. And, you know, fans, they want to try them. They want to get in there and find out, hey, is it really real? And that was the whole concept. This was my dad's stuff. And he always wanted the business to be a shoot. And he wanted the fans to realize that. This can be real. And he was one behind a lot of this. He said, well, let's put him in the ring and let him shoot and then let him come back and work again. So it made it for a long series it was a long 3 months basically of doing this, but I came home better for it, much, much better for it. So I go back out, and Jim's there again, and he says, Ron, I want to introduce you to somebody. He says, you've got your wife, and you've got two babies here. And he goes, you're not going to be able to stay in a hotel. I want to get you set up in an apartment. So he says, he calls to his confidant, his associate. His name was Lonnie. He goes, Lonnie. He's screaming down the hall in the big hotel there. And here comes Lonnie, right? Lonnie struts over, and Lonnie takes me and my wife. First, he takes us into, he says, in the car, he says, do you want an apartment that has a swimming pool? And I said, sure, it's summertime. Now, it's winter there. I mean, it's in December, but we're on the opposite side of the world. It's summer down there, you know? So I said, sure, of course I do. It's summertime, man. It's hot here. It's great. So he takes us to an apartment complex on the water in Sydney Harbor. Now, Sydney Harbor is a body of water that some people say it's the most shark-infested water in the world. And so we go and look at the apartment, and then we go downstairs to look at the swimming pool. So the swimming pool is a bunch of boards, a platform and a walkway about 4 feet wide that goes out about 20 feet. It goes over about 30 feet and back into the bank, another. And it's in the bay. I mean, it's in Sydney. It's in the water where the sharks are, right? And so I asked, I said, what's the deal here? You know, I said, y'all got a lot of sharks here. And Aussie goes, yes, mate, there's sharks here. And he goes, but you can see you got the shark net there, you know? And I said, wait a minute. The shark net goes down to the bottom there, and you create a swimming pool within the shark net? Yeah, mate, he goes, and I said, well, what happens if a shark were to try to get in there? Comes over the top, you know? Well, mate, that might not happen. And if it does, he swim around a bit, and you can get out, and when he gets out, you can get back. You know, it's like, whoa, wait a minute here. So we finally, after a few hours, he takes us to a little community outside of Sydney in the suburbs, a town called Cronulla. He takes us to an apartment complex. It's a 10-story building. It sits high on a hill, and it's overlooking the majestic Pacific. I mean, I've never seen the Pacific. California, Colorado, I mean, Oregon. Geez, I've been down into Mexico. I've never seen the Pacific as beautiful as it is in Australia. It's just fabulously gorgeous. And you stand on the balcony. We go out and we stand on this balcony in this apartment that he shows us, and you can count the swells in the ocean for a half mile out. You see that wave come up, and then it goes down and disappears. And 200 yards closer to the shore, it rises again and it disappears. And then you see the patterns of the waves. Oh, it's just wow. I mean, if you're a surfer or a body surfer, it's like a dream. Like, gosh, I never saw anything like that. And then those big, huge swells, they're going to come down and break on the shoreline, and it's a roar. It just, you can just hear it. The next one comes in. It's just big old spectacular waves. And down below us is the surfers with the boards, and they're surfing. And they're surfing around these huge volcanic rocks that are the size of houses. And I mean, it's like, wow, I'm watching like, geez, they're going to get killed. And they're just maneuvering around these big rocks. And then off to the left, you're standing on the balcony, is this probably 3 mile long. It's a moon shaped, a half moon shaped, beach. It just seems to go forever. It's just beautiful. I mean, and there all along that beach, once you get away from those rocks where the board surfers are, all of the body surfing people are there. And it's just hundreds of them surfing these fabulous waves. And it's like you know, when I think back on it now, it was an unforgettable sight to me, and I still can picture it just like I was standing on that balcony. It's one of the most beautiful sights I ever saw in my life, and I was thinking, wow, I get to be here for 3 months and experience this. It was just really, really phenomenal.
I love body surfing. We've talked about it briefly on the show in the past. Tell me a little bit about body surfing in Australia, because I know you must have gone. How often did you go, and what was it like?
I body surfed every day, Brian, in every city. I'd get a cab. When we flew into a city, I would get in a cab and say, take me to the beach. And I surfed everywhere. And I just loved it. I just really, really loved it. And I go down this afternoon, the first day I'm there, I see these surfers and I get my bathing suit on and I go straight down to the beach. It's probably a 5-minute walk and it's mostly downhill. And when I get down there, I put my feet in that water. And now we're going to talk cold. I mean, you never felt that kind of cold in your life, because you got to figure that the next body of land closest to you is Antarctica. So you've got, a 1,000 miles away, you've got ice caps and all that stuff. And it's just horribly cold. But the waves are just so fantastic. You want to go out there. I see these towers sitting on the beach, and I don't know what they're all about. I just go in the water. I just want to catch waves. And I get out there, and you could go out probably 300 yards from shore and catch a wave and ride those suckers sometimes for 50, 60 yards. I mean, great waves that just kept carrying you and carrying you. So I'm out there the very first day, first time I go out, and I hear this horn on the beach go off. And I'm like, well, I didn't think anything about it, So, and I go out and I catch another wave. And then I get out there and I notice that, hell, everybody's kind of going in, So I'm like, I don't know what's the deal, but I'm still catching waves. Hey, what are y'all going? I'm just going to hell with them. I'm going to stay out there. And finally, there's an Aussie guy, and he's probably the closest guy to me and one of the last people headed toward the beach. And he screams at me and he says, hey, mate. He goes, the shark horn, mate. And I said, the what? The waves are crashing and the big noise and the big surf. And he goes, the shark horn. And I said, what? I can't figure out what he's saying. And the third time he goes, mate, that's the shark horn. And I said, shark horn. Oh. So I was the first guy on the beach. I mean, I just beat everybody. I was just thrashing, and I couldn't get to the beach fast enough. I'm thinking, whoa, man, there's shark out here. And so you get on the beach, and all the Aussies, I'm literally the first guy on the beach. They're kind of just going slowly in because they're used to this. It happens all the time there, right? And so I get on the beach, and I'm standing there, and they're all complaining. Oh, God, another shark, man. I want to get back in the water, And a helicopter comes down the beach. He goes down the beach, this big, long beach, and to the far end of the big moon there, the moon-shaped beach, and back to here again. And then he talks to the guys on the tower. I think the guys in the tower are lifeguards. They don't give a damn about saving your life. They're there to watch for sharks, right? So he goes, the guy in the helicopter comes by and he talks to the shark guys in the shark tower. And he goes, you got a 12-foot Mako and a 15-foot white out here. He's like, whoa. I'm like, wait a minute, man. I don't know if I want to go back out there or not, So, and then he flies up and down the coast there for a while. They watch the sharks. They see the sharks. Water's real clear. And when the sharks go away, The horn goes off again. When the horn goes off, I mean, they thunder into the water. All these Aussies, they just go crashing into the surf, man. They're just crazy to get back in. And I sat up there on the beach probably for about 10 minutes. I'm thinking, I'm going to see a shark get somebody here. I'm not going to go right. I'm running back out there right away. But that's just an indication of what it was like being there and how crazy that the whole atmosphere is. Just pretty remarkable as compared to the United States. And obviously, they got a shark problem there, and they have the big boys there. And you have to get used to that. You're going to body surf there. And I went to a lot of beaches that had no shark patrol. And I went ahead and body surfed for hours at a time and never really worried about it. And luckily, I made it back with all my limbs.
You're 6'9". Do you have an advantage in the water of seeing the shark while you're waiting for a wave?
No, not really. You know, because you're pretty much like somebody on a board. You know, you're staying kind of keep upright. You know, but when you got those big waves and a small wave there is a 6-foot wave, and some of them. I saw 20s there before. I've seen 20-footers. In fact, one time I was in the water with a set of three. Usually those big waves come in sets. And I was with an Aussie guy. And we were catching. They were probably in about 12-footers that day. And then there comes these three monsters. You can see them way out there. You see the swell being way bigger than the rest of them. And when they start getting ready to get that curl, I start ready to catch one, and there's an Aussie there guy, and he's not said anything to me, but he sees me getting ready to catch it, and he goes, I don't think I'd take that one if I were you, mate. So I backed out of it. I said, okay, well, and then I watched that wave. Whoa. I mean, it was a crusher, you know, and then the next one comes and it's a little bigger than that one. And then the third one is the biggest one in the set. And, he didn't have to tell me on that one. You know, when you're in the water and you got a 20-foot or 15-18-foot wave, it's like a 2-story building above you where that sucker is. And, you don't jump on them boys, too darn quickly.
Oh, no. And the whole idea of body surfing, knowing there are sharks there, like you said, you went to the beach with no shark patrol. That is scary.
Oh, yeah. I got stories. We're going to get into all kinds of shark stories. And some of them are pretty spectacular. I mean, so I'm just learning here. And this is my first day. I go home. And just to give people an idea of what Australia is all about, my wife says, let's go get some groceries. So we go down and you think you're going to go to the supermarket or whatever. But we get down there and there's a little tiny grocery store and it just has the canned goods and stuff like that. And next door, two doors down, is the butcher. And two doors beyond that is another. You know, there are no supermarkets. The country in Australia at that point is probably about 20 years behind the United States. So we go into the butcher and we want to get a roast. She's going to make a roast. And so we go into the butcher and I say to the guy, he's got a case there, a meat case. And it's got some cuts in there of different types of meat. And I say, I want a rump roast. And he goes, a rump roast, mate? He goes, how big? And I said, 3 pounds. And he goes, okay. And he goes and opens this door and goes into a back room. It's a cooler. And he takes a whole side of beef. It's a tire steer cut in half. It's hooked by his foot at the top of the ceiling. And all of his body, all the way down, it has the rump, it has his ribs, it has the shoulder, and he gets behind it and he pushes that big old hunk of beef out of the cooler out to where we're standing, and it's on a track, it's on a big track, it probably weighs 300 pounds at least. And he says, well, how big you want, mate? And I said, about 3 pounds. And he takes a butcher knife and he jams it in the ass of this big hunk of big steer, and he just cuts out a big hunk of meat, slaps it on the table there, and says, "There you go, mate." You know, he puts it in from paper, and it was very inexpensive. I was like, "Wow, I've never seen anything like that before." We go next door to the grocery store, and we pick up everything that we want there, and they say, they go, "Where you live, mate? We're paying." We say, "Where you live, mate?" And they said, "Well, we're in the department up here, such and such." And "What's your address?" And we give him the address. And he says, "And we're starting to collect the groceries to get the bags, right?" And he goes, no, mate." He goes, no. What are you doing?" And they said, "Well, we're getting the groceries. We're taking them home." He said, no, we're going to deliver them. "We'll bring you the groceries to your house, mate." And he goes, "You live there?" And I said, "Yeah." And he gets the address. We go up 20 minutes later, knock on the door, go and open the door. There's a guy with all the groceries and the meat, the big hunk of meat. And he says, "Where's your kitchen, mate?" And I said, "What's right there?" And he kind of just pushes me out of the way. And he goes into the kitchen and he starts putting the stuff in the refrigerator and putting the canned goods in the cabinet. I mean, it's like, wow, what in the heck is this all about? And then he gets ready to leave. And I go, "Here, I dig in my pocket, you know, and I pull out, a tip." And I said, "Here, man, here." And he goes, "What's that, mate?" And I said, "It's a tip." He goes, "What's a tip?" And I said, "It's a gratuity. I mean, it's a way of thanking you. I want to give you something for doing all this for us." And he goes, "Oh, no, mate." He goes, "That might be all right in America, but," he says, "here in Australia, we don't take those tips, you know." I was like, wow. So my first day was just a real eye-opener when it came to dealing with the Aussie people and just being involved in a totally different lifestyle than what I was accustomed to in 1973 in America.
You said this may be several episodes. You weren't lying. We got through one day so far here on the Studcast in Australia, so we'll have more next week. But as we wrap things up, Ron, a few notes. You can become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook. The page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can follow the Tennessee Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts. Of course, go to tnstud.com for every single episode of the Studcast, as well as access to the Super Studcast, the rest of the story, as well as Tennessee Stud souvenirs, photo gallery, and so much more. tnstud.com. And on the topic of the Super Studcast, you heard it earlier. Super Studcast number 10, Jim Cornette, will be coming at you on Tuesday, October 9th. Once again, go to tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast, only $2.99. Ron, I know you're excited about this because Jim isn't just a friend. Jim's one of your favorites.
Oh, I love Jim. Jim is he's kind of like Barnett, except in a totally different way. I mean, he's a character in his own right. And gosh, almighty. He's off the wall. He's everywhere. He's bouncing off the walls. I love Jim, and I know we're going to have a tremendous, tremendous program. I can't wait for people to get this one because, gosh, Jim's amazing. I mean, he is probably one of the most popular people in podcasting out there, period. And, I just really pleased and honored to have him on the program. And, I think this will be a really, really good Super Studcast.
Jim will be on Super Studcast number 10, once again debuting on Tuesday, October 9th at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. But what's on next week's Studcast, Ron?
Well, we're going to get into a wrestling ring. You know, I mean, we kind of went through a little bit of what it's like to be in Australia, but we're going to jump into a wrestling ring. We're going to do quite a few wrestling rings, and we're going to talk a lot of wrestling next week. And we're going to talk about learning to drive on the wrong side of the road. That's an experience too. And And that's what happens when you're in some countries, and Australia obviously is the deal. I'm going to buy myself a real nice, fancy $400 English Ford so that I can have my own car. So, I mean, we're going to really experience Australia, and I just can't wait to really get into the nuts and bolts of this country.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.